Chris seemed very calm during his interview. A few times he seemed to get frustrated with Special Agent Coder over certain questions that he was asked, mostly related to what conversation he and Shanann had had right before he left for work. It was extremely important for Special Agent Coder to dig into the reason behind their emotional conversation or what exactly was said. Chris had filled out a written statement about what was said, and it was very interesting because Chris wrote probably a paragraph about packing up for work that day, loading his truck, things like that. Pretty much one line about his emotional conversation with his wife, and then another paragraph of what he did after that, you know, going to work and things like that. So we knew the important stuff is with this emotional conversation that he is neglecting to talk to us about.
He was so extraordinarily calm and was internally inconsistent in what he was saying and how he was saying it, that it raised a lot of red flags. It just really struck everyone as, what in the world is going on?
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clemente, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor and writer-producer of CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today is...
Laura Richards, criminal behavioral analyst, former New Scotland Yard, author of the Dash Risk Assessment and of the Policing Domestic Violence book.
All righty. And I'm Lisa Zambetti. I'm the casting director for CBS's Criminal Minds. And we are jumping right back in to the psychopathy checklist that Jim and Laura are analyzing for us regarding Chris Watts.
Okay, well, let's get on to the next trait or characteristic.
Shallow effect, superficial emotional responsiveness. To see how he was practically thinking almost immediately after committing these horrific murders, selling the house, calling Nikki and making plans, all that kind of stuff. Those kinds of things we see in psychopaths, their ability to recover because they are so shallow, they are so superficial. And I think seven, the shallow effect and superficial emotional responsiveness, and callousness and lack of empathy. I think those two he scores very high on. And, you know, I would give him a 3 if I could on both of those.
Do you agree, Laura? I gave him a 2 on both of those. The callous lack of empathy, his lack of behavioral range, you know, emotional range. And that's what I'm seeing the whole way through. So, you know, the callous disregard. Whilst he's writing these love notes to Nikki saying he wants to wake up with her, wants to be with her, wants to love her, he wants to live with her, and he uses a quote from a song, Shanann is desperately writing a letter to him saying, tell me what you need, let's fix this. And he's just batting off her continuously and just carrying on as normal. So when you see those dual responses, you just realize his callous lack of empathy for Shanann, the children, effectively, of what he's doing.
Right.
So 2 and 2.
All right. And so now we get to parasitic lifestyle. And this is a little interesting because although at certain points he is the breadwinner in the house, there are certain points where he is not and he's living off Shanann. And even when he is the breadwinner, he's relying on her to do, like you said, the meal prep and take care of the kids and service him, you know, make sure everything his needs are taken care of, whereas hers are not. So I would say that's parasitic.
I gave him 1 initially, and then the more I dug in and saw that actually it seemed that Shanann was being very industrious and working very hard, and people were judging her for that. That's a side issue, but the fact that she's doing all of these things and even on Facebook to better their situation and family. And I think, Lisa, didn't you say that at some point she had 3 jobs?
Yeah. Just from what I can read, it's that he did all the chores. He organized the entire basement and had to send her photos of how he did it. I mean, which I have done with my husband before, by the way. I said, did you water the plants? Here, take a picture and show me. You know, so it seemed like he was very involved in getting the girls. His job in the morning was to get their milk ready and their lunches. I think they shared, I mean, she definitely was the manager. Shannon was definitely the manager of the house, but he had to keep things the way that she wanted it. And he went along with it. But I mean, he certainly worked hard out in the field. It sounds like I'm trying to defend him, folks. And I absolutely am not trying to defend him. I just want to be looking with as clear of eyes as possible. That
right. You know, and what period of time was that? When did that happen?
Right up until they left, until he started his affair with Nicole. He went from being a garage mechanic to being out in the field, a big jump in salary and benefits when he got that job with Anadarko, and being out in the field and having to climb, you know, as we know, he was out there fixing all kinds of things and working hard and coming right back home, picking up the girls from school. He had to be right back and getting them into bed. And so it felt like a partnership, but he was, you know, he carried his load, the load that she wanted him to carry.
So there was a division of labor, but let's go back to the parasitic aspect. Was there a point where she was working three jobs? And
in the beginning, yeah.
Was that after the debt issue? Was that after the bankruptcy?
She was in debt. She had massive credit card debt before they got married. And they were so in a hurry to leave Northern North Carolina that she sold her house at a loss. And so when they had to get their new house, they had to use his credit. So I think she was always a little bit behind and always hustling to work. And I think she worked, the third job was at a children's clothing store so that she could get discount on the girls'
clothes. But was he ever working two or three jobs?
Well, he had a full-time job.
I know.
Part-time jobs, it's because you're either working a low-paying part-time job and you need to supplement it. Right. So, I mean, I don't know.
It could be that she's working a full-time job and another job and another job. I mean, just because it's three jobs doesn't mean they're not full-time.
Well,
what were the jobs that she was working?
So she was administrator at a hospital, and then she worked at a children's clothing store. I think the three part-times added up to full-time hours. And then she quit all those jobs because she started working for Lavelle, which she loved. That was something she thought that she could do very well. She's a natural salesperson. And I think, they worked at the same Longmont Ford together. He was the mechanic and she was an internet salesperson. So they were together a lot in the beginning of their stay in Colorado, which can be very bonding and it's, you're with each other all the time. And then once you're not working together anymore, the relationship changes. But anyway, that's all I know.
But there's some kind of shift, like when Nikki's on the scene, because of what Shannon wrote on her Facebook post, where I'm going to do the food shopping, then I'm going to do his meal prep, then I'm going to pack the bags, then I'm going to pack my bag, mm-hmm. and all of this to allow Chris for his bachelor life. So there was clearly some kind of shift. And he was doing the burn program, I think, at this time. And she had kind of commented and taken a picture or a video of him mowing the lawn, saying, "Here's my sexy man." So she was clearly still very into him at that point. But he was much more energy doing jobs. And it's not to say the division of labor, that there wasn't some kind of divide. And maybe he was doing more at different points. But that's what the equal partnership should look like. Mm-hmm. I just got a sense that she was far more, maybe it was her drive, maybe she was far more industrious, you know, maybe it's just, actually, Chris had deleted his Facebook page, so you probably didn't see anything off his page because he deleted it weeks before, which again, I think is very interesting. Mm. So, I mean, I put him as one on parasitic lifestyle. I felt that she was the drive, but I think that might be overgenerous, even giving one. If we think that it was far more equal and even in terms of their partnership. But maybe we should go with a zero if it sounds like it was more equal and even in the partnership.
I guess we could.
Subject to further information.
All right. So the next is poor behavioral controls. And I believe that the behavior that we saw, this affair that he obviously chose to get involved in and then continue to promulgate over months, and then which culminated in him deciding to kill his wife and children, shows incredibly poor behavioral controls and just easily ranks him as a 2, because anybody who can't control that kind of behavior and turns to murder to get out of a quote situation, a non-life-threatening situation, I think that shows incredibly poor behavioral control.
Would you put that in that particular event? I mean, other things, I see him quite controlled in his behavior. So, I mean, I erred on more the side of caution here, Jim and Lisa. I actually went for a 1.
Okay. Well, I guess if it balances out, then that's fine. But I just think the actual crime shows very poor behavioral controls, as it shows a number of other things that we're about to get to. So sexual promiscuity, I mean, he was active sexually with his wife, and then he was sexually active with his girlfriend.
With Nikki, yes.
Yeah. So,
I mean, there were other people who came forward, by the way, claiming they'd had sex with him and, you know.
During the marriage?
Yeah.
Well, I think they were discounted.
I don't know how much that they were truthful accounts. I have to say there were a couple that looked fairly spurious to me, but I would have to deep dive that a little bit more. Certainly, I gave him originally a 0, then I gave him a 1 in the basis that, of course, he did cheat with Nikki, but yeah. Was so sexually promiscuous. I mean, certainly not as much as what we've seen with other people, but I'm not sure we're still seeing the real Chris Watts. There may be other things that he was up to.
To have an affair or to cheat a couple of times might be a 1, but to have this full-on affair where he is telling Nikki that he's going to leave his wife, or that he left his wife. And in fact, he hasn't left his wife, never had the first conversation with her about it. And yet he continues to have a sexual relationship with her, bring her over to the house, continue that kind of thing. I don't know. I think that's pretty promiscuous. It's not just a one-off deal. It was a semi.
Is promiscuity multiple? I mean, how many partners you have, or how much sex you have? Or I mean, I think of John Meehan as being promiscuous, or RSS, you know, Richard Scott Smith is being promiscuous. I'm just wondering what the line is and your definition.
It's difficult to say, you know, because all I can say is that he's definitely involved. And I think I would agree with that as a 1.
Yeah. I mean, I'm at a 1 until we see further evidence that is clear that there were multiple sexual relationships. So a 1, where are we next on the
early
checklist?
Behavioral problems. I don't know of any. Do you have any from the details, Lisa?
0. He had an older sister, about 7 years older than he was, she wanted to be popular, and she had a huge circle of friends, but there was a lot of drama apparently with her at home, according to both mother, father, Chris, and, you know, everybody's accounts. So he really wanted to be the good kid. His mother describes him as an easy teenager. I'm not sure if that's accurate or not, but it seems like he had a very small circle of friends. He just wanted to be a regular guy. He didn't want to be as popular as his sister, never got into trouble, never had parking tickets or anything.
All right. Well, then we'd have to give him a 0 on that.
Guess what, girls? Mommy has a baby in her belly.
Yay!
Are you guys excited?
Yeah.
Yes? Are you really excited? Oh my goodness. Come give me hugs.
Oh!
I love you, girl.
I got the baby a hug.
You want to give the baby a hug? I love you, Bella. You're so sweet.
The next one is lack of realistic long-term goals. Difficult to know. I don't know that we have any indication of this other than what he's telling Nikki about what's going to happen. I don't know. Do you know anything about it, Laura?
Well, I mean, I put a question mark here. I think it's something we don't know enough about.
Right.
scoring it, it would be zero. He formed the impression in my mind that he was quite happy. And again, it kind of harks back to the parasitic lifestyle. He's quite happy to roll along with someone else and let them dictate and determine the future and what that looks like. I would say that probably the long-term goals with when he was with Shanann were much more what she decided they would be, and he was very happy to roll along with that. But of course, then that shifted with Nikki. We know that we've got a different set of goals coming in. Are they realistic? Well, certainly what he did on that night, was it realistic to just disappear by brutally murdering your own family, your entire family, and then just carry on as normal with your girlfriend? I mean, at that event, it's very clear that his choices would not take him to his long-term goal. It would land his sorry ass in prison.
Right.
So in that one event, but do we see anything prior to that? Not really. So do we score him a one on that, or do we score him a zero? Because we haven't seen it as a plural.
I don't know. I just don't think we have
enough information.
Yeah.
So we'll have to go zero for now.
I mean, he went to school to become a car mechanic. He became a car mechanic. It didn't seem like he had these unrealistic, I'm going to go on the road and be Jack Kerouac and become a famous writer, or, you know.
Yeah, I don't think we have any indication of that. So the next one is impulsivity. And I think we can kind of move quickly through some of the rest of these. So impulsivity, I think his actions, although they were not all just spur of the moment, because obviously for 2 months he was engaging in an affair with Nikki, he was making plans with her and so forth, but impulsivity to kill your wife and basically in front of your children and then kill your children and then bury or throw them into tanks without any real planning or thought, it's just completely impulsive. It's a very poor set of actions. And I think he should get a two for that.
I gave him a one on that because, again, in the event, we know that in the event he's showing impulsivity, but are we seeing it across the events leading up to that event? And that's why it's difficult, because you can't just take, for me, I can't just take that, the family wipeout, the bad choices that he took on that night, without the rest of the context behind it. And this is where I think a lot of people found him to be, as Lisa described. When you look, he's the father that's there, he's playing with the children, and he looks relatively on the surface normal in the way that he's behaving, the way that he's interacting is not standing out. So I gave him a one, because I would want to hear from more people who would maybe talk to his impulsivity. You know, he didn't strike me as that sort of person. Okay. Being impulsive the whole way through. Was his relationship with Nikki impulsive? Yes, I believe it was.
Right.
Was his behavior on the night impulsive? Yes, I believe it was. But I'd want to hear more for it to be a two, of it to be significant.
Right. All right. And then irresponsibility. Now, this is as distinguished from the next factor, which is failure to accept responsibility. But is he irresponsible? In certain respects, I mean, during the relationship with Nikki, the affair with Nikki, he wasn't being responsible with respect to his children. He wasn't calling them up and saying goodnight or reading to them over the phone or whatever. But again, that's a limited period of time. So I would give him a one, because I think he was being responsible other than that. But when he decided to have this irresponsible, impulsive affair, he became irresponsible. So I'd give him a one on that.
Yeah, I mean, irresponsibility, I scored him zero up until the event, up until Nikki, up until the event. So again, you could probably say it could be a one or it could be a zero. But the failure to accept responsibility, I gave him a two. At no point has he ever accepted responsibility. And that has been continuous and consistent. So I'm a two on failure to accept responsibility.
All right. And then the next is many short-term marital relationships. We have to give him a zero on that. Juvenile delinquency, we have no indication of that. We have to give him a zero on that. Revocation of conditional release, because he's never been convicted of anything that we know of before. We have to give him a zero on that. Criminal versatility. He committed a number of crimes all at the same time. And I think criminal versatility speaks of multiple different types of crimes at different times.
Yes, it does.
And so I'm not aware of any criminal history, so I can't give him anything on that. I think we're going to have to give him a zero on that. So the last four, I think we have to give him zeros for, some because we don't have enough information, some because he just doesn't have any indication of that. So if we do a quick mathematical addition here.
I mean, I've got it as 18 or 19, depending on whether he scored on, I think it was proneness to boredom.
Yeah, that's what I have. Mm-hmm. I have 18, possibly 19. So just for our listeners, in order to be actually categorized as a psychopath on the PCLR, you have to score 30 or above. And here we have 18 or 19. Now, some of it is because we have insufficient information. But other things are because we see, as Lisa pointed out, one pattern of behavior that seemed to be prominent in his life, and then a radical shift in that behavior. And was that because he'd always wanted to do this, always thought about doing this, always really wanted to do that, but Shanann kept him in line and prevented him from doing that and made him look like a good father from the outside? Or is that because he sort of blossomed and became the man he wanted to be and lived out his fantasy life, which many people keep private for their whole lives? We don't know. But many of these behaviors are incredibly, incredibly disturbing. And this is a perfect example of why, when people think that, well, I know this person and he's narcissistic and he's always doing crazy things and he's very charming and all that, so he's a psychopath. Well, actually, you have to go through the whole list and really evaluate him and analyze the behavior, as we've tried to do here today. And you'll see that we can't actually categorize him as a psychopath, can we, Laura?
No, I think, I mean, for me, I never really saw overt signs of psychopathy other than Jim, the lack of empathy, the lack of remorse, the callous disregard, the fact that he's mimicking behavior, mm-hmm. The fact that he appears to not feel guilty about what happened.
No remorse.
Yeah, and we know those things really do stand someone out.
Yeah, those are tentpole parts of psychopathy, but there are other necessary characteristics that we just don't see here.
There are. And so I think what we're seeing, and I always felt from when I first analyzed this case, I felt that he was much more about his selfish needs and desires and feeling entitled. And he did it because he could. You know, people forget Occam's razor, the most simplest explanation. They try and find all these fancy reasons for why someone did something in these moments. And for me, I still come back to this looks like a domestic violence murder on separation, where we know 76% of murders happen. And potentially Shanann said, you're not having the children. You've done all of these things. I now know that you've been cheating on me. The hands go around the neck, which increases the risk of serious harm and homicide. She's pregnant. And in pregnancy, that's a high risk too. Pregnancy and new birth. They had debt. Bringing a third child into the world, which he wanted originally, it changed. Mm. And behavior is dynamic, but it's his sense of entitlement, his sense of narcissism, that it's all about him. All about him, but particularly when he's working out and he's feeling himself and the weight loss, the feeling more confident, this introvert now is being seen and getting attention. I see a very different person. And he was the one that was saying that the spark wasn't there. We heard him say it on interview. Other friends say that he was saying he was being distant. He was getting aggravated with Shanann and the children, that Sandy said he wasn't paying Shanann the attention when she was ill or being supportive. Things changed and shifted. Mm-hmm. So what you're seeing of Chris on the Facebook and, you know, this perfect dad image was manicured and was image management anyway, but he probably did do those things. And he probably, relatively speaking, was happy with his lot to a degree. But I do think there was resentment building over a period of time. And that deep-seated resentment, that entitlement, that selfish side to him, that's the reason why he acted out. And I don't buy his version of he had no control over it. He had absolute control over it. And not just over what he did to Shanann, but the girls too, his two daughters. And that is just unforgivable.
Yeah, I mean, he exercised incredible control during that time. And it is mind-boggling how a father could do that.
I was going to say, it's also mind-boggling that people just want to find very rational explanations for sometimes things that just are not rational choices or decisions that are taken. And I think a lot of what he did was just about serving himself with this black and white thinking, the rigidity. There's probably actually, Jim and Lisa, a personality disorder here. I mean, you know, I'm not assessing him. He's not in front of me. And it would take a psychiatrist, a psychologist who understands domestic abuse, coercive control, who understands psychopathy to assess him and not really understand over time what's going on. But I suspect there's a personality disorder.
You know, obviously our goal was to minimize and allow him to have some justification in what he had done. Special Agent Coder had brought up the fact that maybe it was Shanann's fault. You know, it's common in these types of cases that there's some victim blaming, so that it's easier for the suspect to say, yeah, it wasn't all just me. Like, I did it because they pushed me to it, or I was forced to do it, or some other reason. So we definitely knew Shanann was the stronger personality of the two. So we wanted to use that to our benefit as far as giving Chris a possible reason as to why this would have happened. The second I had brought that theme up to him, his eyes lit up. And I knew to myself, this is the one he wants. This is the theme he wants to go with. He wants to put the blame on her. Vilifying Shanann in the way I felt like we had to do in that instance was a way that we could move forward. It was a stepping stone for us in the investigation so that we could get one more piece. If we could have him admit to even murdering one of them and then, you know, telling us where they were, we would get answers even from that. We just needed to find Shanann and the girls. That was our biggest focus. And we needed to know what he was willing to admit and what he wasn't willing to admit.
And the other thing, actually, Jim, and it is an important point, is that I do believe that more domestic violence offenders should be screened for psychopathy, that the PCLR should be routinely used, because we find a lot of psychopaths in the domestic violence world, but they're not routinely screened for.
Yeah, of course. I mean, that would be the place where psychopathy would play out the most within the confines of the home. So, yeah, I agree. It should be. But this has been a really interesting discussion.
Wow. I feel so tired after this. It's like going through the ringer thinking about this case.
Yeah. This case is just haunting. And I just want to go back to the fact that we do know the home is the most dangerous place for women. And in particular, when there's separation, it's the most dangerous place. So everyone thinks that they know what domestic violence looks like. Everyone thinks that they know what abuse and coercive control looks like, but more often times people don't. And as I said, when we talked to Jenny, at least a third of domestic violence murders have no physical injury reported up until the point of the homicide event. But you do see aspects of control related behaviors, and control can shift. And I still believe the emotional temperature was what he controlled in the relationship, and that he was in control of it and Shanann was not. And the control also comes with the gaslighting, financial abuse, spending money that has not been agreed upon on other things. That's financial abuse, the manipulation, the continuous emotional abuse of Shanann. And people might not even call it that. And I would imagine that if Shanann were alive, and I wish that she were, she wouldn't see herself as a victim of domestic abuse in any event either. But sadly, she was. And I do believe that the Occam's razor aspect comes into it, that the two children walked in and there was a very high price of them being light sleepers and walking in, and he took Chris Watts took some catastrophic decisions, and I just wish that we stopped trying to give him an out for why he did what he did and search for a narrative that fits. You know, this constant searching of the confession tapes and Chris Watts said this and all these women are writing to him in prison and giving him the microphone is what I have a problem with.
Yeah.
That's why the documentary, American Murder, The Family Next Door, I do agree that gave her, Shanann, the microphone. It gave the children a microphone. It gave the family a microphone. And we shouldn't just keep giving it back to the person who commits these heinous crimes as if it's only their narrative that's important, because it's not.
Yeah, I completely understand and agree with what you're saying. But I do think there's a lot of people who the interest is just like we've been talking about this entire time. How could this happen? It's just so unthinkable. So I think that's what keeps it alive, because people just don't understand what you've said, that, you know.
Yeah. Don't try to understand it. You're not going to be in that mind space to understand it. It's mm-hmm. not understandable behavior, but it was a decision he made. He made that decision and he followed through with it.
Do you think he understands? Do you think that he's got the self-awareness or self-reflection to even understand why he did it?
I don't think he cares. He would first have to feel remorse. He would first have to feel bad about it.
Yeah, he would have to accept that that's what he did. But actually, Lisa, I do just want to pick up on something you just said, because I'm just thinking out loud here that in terms of other family wipeouts and other family annihilations, they have not received the attention this case has.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay, and that's the point that I'm also making. There's something about the way that he looks and who he is, not just about the why done it.
Yeah.
It's also about him. And it might be because it was on Facebook, but there are hundreds of other cases that most people like Kelly Fitzgibbons have never even heard of. So what makes this case more remarkable? Why is it? And I think it's because people don't want to believe because of what he looks like and because of the victim blame that went on. I think it's much deeper. It's not just about the why. There's a whole load of victim blame. There's a whole load of judgment. There's a whole load of misogyny and the patriarchal nonsense and noise that goes with it. And I think that's highly problematic when we search out reasons for why he did what he did, as if there is some simple, you know, or some real explanation. And I don't see that in all other cases. And I certainly, if you compare it to the Susan Smith case.
I was thinking about her, yeah.
When you do look at the different genders, when something catastrophic and horrific happens, the female will get vilified in the media, but the male will not. And there is an imbalance there. And I do want to point that out, because that's my life's work, also looking at how cases are reported on, how we understand what's going on, and these kind of myths and these excuses and these reasons for male violence that I come up against every day. There's a reason that women are blamed, even in their own murders, when the only person responsible is the man who decided to murder. So this has been a particularly harrowing, disturbing, and emotional series for all of us on Real Crime Profile. And I know from our listeners, it's been a really tough listen for you too. But I was really grateful to be able to talk about this case with Jim and Lisa. It's a case that's been on my mind since it happened in 2018. And the American Murder, The Family Next Door, I think the documentary is worth people watching. We hear from Shanann herself, and for the first time, it's the victims being given the microphone. And at Real Crime Profile, that's a really important thing for us to have happen. So please remember, listeners, that the home is the most dangerous place for a woman. The statistics are very clear. It's at least 4 women a day who are murdered in America, 1 a week in Australia, 1 woman every 3 days in the UK. And this has increased with the lockdown and with COVID. So again, if you're somebody that a friend or a family member has reached out to, please know there is help out there, and look on our website, Real Crime Profile, and my Laura Richards website, and please point those who are being victimized to the hotlines and helplines, and we'll have them in our show notes and at the end of each episode. So as always, we want to end with remembering and honoring the victims. So hashtag her name was Shanann Watts, hashtag her name was Bella Watts, hashtag her name was CC Watts, hashtag his name was Nico Watts. And for now, This is Real Crime Profile, signing out.
If you like deeper analysis like this episode on topics like Making a Murderer, Mindhunter, Escape at Dannemora,
The Case of Sally Challen, The Teacher's Pet, Lynette Dawson, The Exonerated Five and When They See Us, and The Disappearance of Madeleine McCann, you can listen to RCP on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or whatever platform you listen to us on. And please be sure, if you like what we do, to give us a 5-star review.
Thank you for listening to Real Crime Profile.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineering by Mike Thal. Music is composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107, or you can go to the website where there's a lot of information and advice that you can follow on www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic abuse, you can call the National Domestic Violence Helpline for free on 0800 200 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter or counselling, you can call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, on 214-946-4357. You can also go to their website for further advice or support, www.genesisshelter.org. And there's the domestic violence hotline on 800-799-7233.